And now we begin the second session with Bruce Elsmore on the same date. And it seems to me that we have left over from before, primarily to talk about your lunar occultation experiment of IC443 and the crab also. Now, what was the main reason for doing this experiment?
Partly, I suppose, because nobody had observed a lunar occultation of a radio source before, and so the observation of IC443 was in fact the first lunar occultation measurement. That also aroused our interest in the lunar atmosphere, because during the course of that occultation there was a fairly well-defined sort of nebulosity part of IC443. IC443 is a very large object compared with the size of the Moon, but there was this fairly small, compact bit of bright H-alpha emission which got covered over by the Moon. And we noticed that at the time that that was occulted, we in fact got a bump on our measurement of the radio emission from IC443. And this enabled me to put a limit on the lunar atmosphere, because one can calculate that the time was just about right from the geometry of the occultation, that there wasn't very much bending in the lunar atmosphere.
I see. Now, how did this come about? Because this is sort of completely outside the line at Cambridge.
It wasn't really. Yeah. We had been doing experiments on the sun.
That's right.
Seeing the effect of sources disappearing behind the solar corona, and so naturally when you have a moon doing very much the same sort of thing, it wasn't very much of a jump to talk about effects of the lunar atmosphere. And well, this is really why that sort of line of approach took place.
And so you found out something about the distribution of the IC443.
That's right, yes.
Which was interesting, but I suppose even more interesting was this lunar atmosphere business.
Yes.
I mean, what did you find out, at least in the first study, which was Elsmore and Whitfield, 55, I believe?
I think we found out, we provided upper limit for the density of the lunar atmosphere.
Less than 10 to the 7th per cubic centimeter.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Which I probably didn't surprise any of the pundits at the time.
No, not at all.
Right.
But then we went on to do the occultation of the crab.
In 56.
What was that, a couple of years later or something like that?
Well, the 55 one was Nature, so I imagine that the lunar occultation, was April 55. I have that down here.
Yes.
And then I guess the next year you did the crab.
That's right. That was probably a year.
And Costain, Elsmore, and Whitfield is the publication.
Yeah, well, that was the actual observation of the occultation itself, giving more or less the radio technique that we employed to do the observation.
But you do mention, even in that paper, that you now have a definite number of about 10 to the 4th per cubic centimeter
That's
for the atmosphere.
Right.
And then in Phil Mag, I guess you worked it out
more accurately.
More accurately.
Got it down to about 10 to the 10 cubed.
Right.
Yes. Now, you might be interested to know that in recent lunar landings, they had devices left on the Moon for measuring the density of the electron content of the lunar atmosphere, and they again came up with numbers of the order of 10 cubed per cubic centimeter.
And how high?
This was the sort of level of emission from the lunar surface. So this was very close to the lunar surface, but
you mean within a meter or
Right. Like that sort of height. And so we were, in fact, in the right sort of camp for me.
But could you really detect that? I mean, given all the irregularities of the surface, it would seem to me like you can't really.
What we said is, we worked out various scale heights for the lunar atmosphere.
Yeah.
And if the scale height was whatever it was, certainly a few hundred meters or something like that, then we were able to say that the electron content was about 10 cubed. And there's a table in that particular paper. I can't actually recall it because I haven't looked at the paper for such a long time. But about a couple of years ago, in Sky and Telescope, I actually came across it with these results of published lunar landing mm-hmm. measurements. And at the time I compared them, and they weren't in disagreement with the occultation observations.
I'll have to check that.
Yes. The thing which I suppose is in greatest doubt is when we actually work out from the electron content to go to saying that, you know, what the lunar atmosphere is like, because we're only really talking about the charged particles.
Right.
And going from there to an ordinary atmosphere, that's where the biggest jump comes. I expect this is always suspect.
How much was this excess refraction?
I think it was something like 0.4 of a second of time.
I see, and you had the timing down well enough that you
yes,
you
because
could
the moon
that.
Moves relatively slowly compared to the source. I mean, it has a very large factor of amplification mm-hmm. of ordinary time.
And was this? Did you repeat this experiment more than once?
No, we haven't. The trouble with the moon is it doesn't really lend itself to repeating these observations. There was only one really good occultation of the crab from Cambridge. There were sort of near misses and partial occultations.
Yeah.
But one has to wait anything up to about 18 and two-third years for the complete recycle.
Right.
And we haven't, as you say, repeated it. Mainly because when more recent lunar occultations have been observed, we haven't had the apparatus working at such a low frequency, such a long wavelength.
Which is needed to get
which is needed to get this sort of measurement.
Right.
At high frequencies, the effect is so much smaller. You really want to do these experiments at long wavelengths.
And it wasn't high priority enough to take some apparatus
no,
to
that's
somewhere.
Right. No,
either.
Especially with people who were actually on the moon at the time. And,
you'd probably pick up their S-band
yes.
or something. Well, there's a brief thing here where you try to detect radiation from Jupiter. I presume this was 1960 when it was published. That's a few years after it was discovered.
Yes.
The idea was to see if you got some high-frequency radiation, I guess.
That's right, yes.
Was it not clear at that time?
I don't think it was.
Where the cutoff was?
No, we weren't really sure. So it was quite a... At its time, it was quite a useful experiment, but of course now it's completely superseded.
Yeah.
It is. So I think that is probably not really worth worrying too much about.
Okay. Well, the final thing is the beginnings of the 4C survey.
Yes.
And maybe I should ask, what was the goal of the 4C as opposed to 3C? I mean, was it always, even before you began 3C, was it clear there was going to be a 4C, or was it as a...
I suppose, yes, even when we were doing 3C, we obviously envisaged going deeper than the 3C catalogue, which is only some 400 sources. And so, even at those days, we probably were thinking in terms of going deeper, but quite how we were going to achieve the necessary resolution and so on wasn't obvious in those days. But the contribution I made here with Val and Leslie was we did a lot of observations really to calibrate the 4C, both positionally, well, mainly for the positions, so that all the other positions of the 4C objects could be tied onto the framework of fairly bright sources.
So you had cal sources in each deck range?
That's the sort of thing, yes, and that's really what we were involved with there.
Right. So is it fair to say then that the 4C was not really being thought of during the 2C, because there you were coming up with enough sources, so
that's
to speak.
Right, but yes.
Once that had to be thrown out.
Once we threw out 2C, then we had 3C, which was down to a sort of what we then thought was a disastrously low number of sources. It was obvious that if we were going to improve the statistics, we would have to go much deeper and get many more sources. So this is sort of an anti-2C, if you would like to look at it like that.
did the Cambridge group at that time have any idea that 3C would become such a standard catalog, or was it?
I don't think so. We still probably had opposition from the Southern Hemisphere observers, and so it wasn't really clear, at least it wasn't clear to me, that 3C would become very firmly established for really the Northern Hemisphere, as it has.
And let me just ask now, you mentioned that it wasn't clear how the increased sensitivity was going to be achieved in 4C without being confusion limited again.
Yes.
How did this develop as to the way to go about doing it?
Well, I think it developed by going to shorter wavelengths and by more careful thought how to get resolution. I mean, just we built a very long aerial, as you know, which had a fairly narrow beam in the east-west direction, and then by having a north-south movable arm, which effectively we have with the 4C aerial, we were able then to see how we could solve the problem of sort of ambiguities in declination. And so it was really simple application of things that we learnt the hard way from the old sort of 3C aerial.
Right. But you say going to a higher frequency. Now, this was only possible because presumably the sensitivity of higher frequency receivers was improved. Is this right?
That's right, yes.
I mean, you would have done that earlier.
Oh,
or
yes,
maybe not.
Definitely. I think it goes along with the advances in techniques in electronics.
Yeah. So that probably would have been done even for 2C if
definitely. I think so, yes. Yeah. Yes, if we'd had the ability to make good low noise receivers at the higher frequencies.
Let me just ask one thing that came up in talking with Mills about the 1C survey.
Oh, yes.
He, of course, was pointing out that the Mills cross, but even before then, his Michelson interferometer, he was went into shorter spacings than the Cambridge group tended to do.
Yes.
And therefore, the 1C survey came out with a pretty isotropic distribution, whereas his first survey came out with these class 1 and class 2 rather different things. How did you view that? Did you see that as that he really was getting a different component that you should be getting, or?
I think it probably threw suspicion on both our approaches. I don't think we were definitely biased to say that Mills was right and we were wrong.
Yeah.
Or the other was, I think it made us very much more aware of what we ought to be looking for. So I think in that sense it was probably quite a useful contribution to make this distinction.
But then throughout the Cambridge surveys, there was not the concern with getting the very shortest spacings. Is that a fair statement, would you say?
I think that's probably true. I think we were very worried about the very small spacings because it was so difficult to distinguish between the large-scale structures of our own galaxy and radio sources, this sort of thing. So we tended to look probably more for much more compact sort of star-like objects in the sky rather than for large diffuse objects.
So in other words, because it becomes ambiguous as to what's the source after a certain point,
you chose to define the
problem in a sense, that you were only going to look at the distribution
of the more or less points, well, as we thought, point sources.
Right. Which, in retrospect, has a definite influence on the answer. I mean, it's the old problem about how you set up an experiment to some extent determines the answer you get.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I'm sure that's true. Yes. But I'm sure we were really concentrating on trying to resolve the smallest objects rather than worrying too much about the larger ones all the way through the whole development of sort of early radio astronomy. Perhaps it's only recently that we've come round to being more concerned about the larger things.
Yeah. Well, John Baldwin made the point that he's always been concerned with extended objects.
He has.
He's sort of
the
lone one in the
Cambridge
group.
He has been. That's right. Yes. I think the majority of the group throughout the ages has always been concerned with the point sources or the small diameter ones.
Right.
And he's been a loner in the respect that he's been interested in the larger scale things.
Well, that takes care of your papers. I wanted to ask one thing about the general, over the years, working in under Martin Ryle.
Yes.
It seems to me that it's incredible how people, having worked with him, sort of developed the same sort of style in a very strong loyalty. I was wondering if you could comment on how that seems to come about. Is it?
I suppose it comes about because, in a way, he's a very good leader of a team, and he certainly. Let's face it. Most of the contributions have originated in some form from him.
Mm-hmm.
And we have sort of helped, I suppose, to make these sort of develop and come to fruition. I think most of the basic ideas have been his, and I would always give him that credit.
Yeah, yeah.
And for that reason, I think that he's had a very strong influence over what we do, simply because he sort of seems to have had the ability to see much further ahead than perhaps any of us have done. So for that reason, I personally felt I sort of been tagging along behind, you know, fairly happy to do that.
Right, right. Well, other people have said this similar sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and certainly that's been,
yeah,
been my sort of attitude. So if there is any explanation, I think that must be the one.
Any other comments that you'd like to make in thinking about the whole thing up through the early 60s?
I really think that those days were perhaps the highlights of Cambridge Radio Astronomy. Although we're still achieving quite useful results, it was the early observations that were, I suppose, more important, because we were breaking the ice so much in those days.
You mean, what you're saying is the field has settled down more in many places?
Yeah, that's right. It's such a vast... I mean, it's studied over the whole world now, whereas there are only two or three centres in those days who are doing it. And the pioneer work, I suppose, is always very much more exciting than when everybody's discovered 1,400 quasars and then trying to find similarities and differences between them. I mean, that has to be done, but it's so much less exciting than discovering the first quasar and this sort of thing.
Right, right. Where would you draw the... where would you put the date as to when the nature of the field changed? You just mentioned quasars. Now that's 63.
No, that's mid-63
or
60, yeah, that's
64
right.
When the first redshifts were picked up anyway.
I suppose up to about that sort of time, really.
But then why would you leave out pulsars and molecular lines?
Well, A, we haven't done very much on molecular lines in Cambridge, therefore we've been not looking at... Pulsars was a very great discovery, but it was fairly short-lived as far as Cambridge is concerned, because there's a great deal of excitement over the sort of 3 or 4 years when they've all been discovered. But here again, we haven't really the instruments for studying pulsars, which are really best observed in large single dishes. So we've really dropped out of the pulsar interest.
So your remarks were more towards Cambridge, you think, in terms of, or would you try to generalize them to all of radio astronomy?
I was really thinking about Cambridge in particular.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, pleasure.
That finishes the interview with Elsmore on 25th August 76.